pressing all the relevant buttons.
Oh, yeah, that's a good plan.
That always helps.
Testing, testing.
Tim's recording and he's remembered his headphones today as well, so we're honoured.
But we don't know yet whether he's remembered his script.
Well, this is true.
Script, what's that?
Make it up as you go along.
Yeah, yeah.
Cool.
Okay, are we good to go?
I believe so.
Yeah, well, take it away, Martin.
This isn't the BBC Light programme.
The Tony Hancock Appreciation Society presents, very nearly an armful, a Tony Hancock podcast.
Hello and welcome to Very Nearly an Armful, brought to you by the Tony Hancock Appreciation Society.
On the podcast, we'll be discussing Tony's famous series, Hancock's Half Hour.
We'll discuss the show, its production, and what we liked about it.
We'll rate or review the episode and just generally get our geek on about vintage comedy.
We're your hosts. I'm James Griffith.
I'm Martin Gibbons.
I'm John Street.
And I'm Tim Elms.
And we're spread across the south of the UK in a line from Wiltshire to Essex via Kent.
And our members are spread all over the world. We have members in Manchester, Winchester, Colchester and Chester.
Hey, to the Colchester, more peer. And in this podcast, we'll be discussing Cinderella Hancock. It was recorded on Monday the 3rd of January and then broadcast the next day, Tuesday the 4th of January, 1955. It's a wonderful pantomime parody featuring guest star Dora Bryan, which was later remade in the third radio series, but only the original performance remains in the archives.
But first of all, chaps, how's everyone been this week?
Yeah, had a
very
good week,
thanks,
this week.
James.
Yeah, all
pretty
good. Plenty of work on at work, but a little bit of telly watching. I don't know if the rest of you have started to watch the Dad's Army animations.
Oh, recorded it. Haven't had a chance yet.
Which are that? So, and I've only seen the one so far, but I say it's original soundtrack from the Lost television episodes, but I think it's only one of them or a couple of them are the Lost, the television soundtracks. The remainder are the radio remakes, but they've taken these original recordings and certainly the one that I saw, I thought was very well put together. It's done in a proper widescreen format, but made in black and white as the original episodes would have been. And I think the animation is an absolute delight to see. It's really well done.
Yeah, I think I saw the first one, A Stripe for Fraser, which is the television soundtrack, when they did that about 5 years ago. So it'll be quite interesting to see, because, of course, the other episodes, the soundtracks are the radio remakes, except with newly recorded voices for Walker, because old James Beck was replaced in the radio show by Graham Stark and then someone else, but they didn't sound that much like James Beck. So you've actually got David Benson, who is known for his Kenneth Williams voices, doing Private Walker, and I think a chap who was also on stage with him doing the Dad's Army radio show a few years ago. So I'll be curious to see how good they sound with those extra bits and the little bit of editing they've done to make it all work.
Yeah, I look forward to listening to that, because I've been working 6 days for the last few weeks, so I'm definitely looking forward to a little bit of time off just to catch up on those, perhaps when the kids go back to school and I can get a later start. Exciting.
Yeah, I mean, I think the actual recording and how they've slotted the voices in, it sounded pretty seamless. It was really well done.
Oh, dear. You know, I think there's only one way to get you out of this, Joe. We shall have to make sure you don't pass your medical.
I don't think Mr. Mannering and Mr. Wilson would approve of this, Mr. Jones. It's not honest.
Fraser!
Aye?
Bring that ladder over, will you?
I will, sir.
Right, now, Joe, take your shoes and socks off.
What for?
You ain't got flat feet, have you?
Of course I ain't.
Well, you soon will have.
Yeah. Here's the ladder, Joe.
Right, thanks, Fraser. Now, Joe, all you've got to do, you keep jumping off this ladder and remember to land flat-footed.
I'm not doing that. It will hurt me.
Well, only at first. You'll soon get used to it.
Oh, there's nothing to it, laddie.
Well, look, you start from the bottom step and you work up.
And remember to land flat-footed.
Right, now off you go, walk up. Ready, Joe? Jump.
Oof!
One.
Up you go again, come right. Jump.
Oh!
Two.
Martin, we exchanged messages about this the other night. There was something about Ian Lavender being replaced.
That's right. So it was both Walker and I think Ian Lavender had the voices from the Dad's Army stage show included. So I think Ian Lavender was replaced as well, and I don't know why that was.
He wasn't replaced.
Was he in the radio episode, Ian Lavender?
Yes, he was in the radio episode.
He was in the radio episode, so I don't know why he was replaced.
Maybe he just sounded that bit too much older, perhaps. But the radio series was concurrent with the TV series, so maybe not. I don't know.
Absolutely, yeah.
No idea.
If any listener knows why Ian Lavender was replaced in the recording, certainly on the first episode that was broadcast on Gold, we'd love to hear from you, because that's a conundrum we don't know the answer to. But all that aside, it was really well done, and how nice would it be if the two Hancock half-hour television episodes that only existed in audio also had the same treatment? That would be rather nice.
Yeah, that'd be great, wouldn't it?
Yeah. So especially as it's the horror serial, which is the pastiche of Quatermass and the Pit, which is a brilliant episode, and The Italian Maid, which is one of the rare television episodes with a guest star. So it would be rather nice to see.
I think The Flight of the Red Shadow, one of the other soundtracks that's not quite as good a quality as those two, but passable, is a much more visual episode. So that would be lovely to see remade or reconstructed in some sense, because there's about three sections about 2 or 3 minutes apiece where from the soundtrack you have no idea what's going on.
Yeah. And in fact, there's one quite lengthy bit in The Italian Maid that's entirely visual.
Yeah.
And again, it would be great to see those. Anyway, that might be us dreaming, or me dreaming, but be good.
You can but dream, can't you?
Indeed.
Well, for myself, I've just been watching the new series, Doctor Who, with David Tennant, all of the sort of the recent ones, in preparedness for the 60th anniversary specials, which are yet to be broadcast at the time that we're recording this podcast, dear listener. So that's one to look forward to.
Yeah, certainly will be. And I did spot... And you have to excuse any rustling behind me whilst I flick through my trusty Radio Times.
That's okay, Russell.
Price a penny, I think they used to say on the Goon Show, didn't they? If only that were the case today.
Oh, it was fourpence in the late 50s when Hancock was on the cover, because I was looking at one recently.
A bit like Hancock's Half Hour's colourised for Gold, they have colourised the 1963 Dalek episode.
They have.
Series, which is being put on in a single programme on the 60th anniversary evening of the 23rd of November, which, as you say, by the time this goes live, will have been on. But probably worth trying to see if you can see that on iPlayer if you didn't see it when it was on.
The planet is dead. Totally dead. Whatever it was destroyed, everything that was living.
Over 500 years ago, there were two races on this planet.
We are the survivors of a final war.
The Daleks. And the Thals. Emergency! Emergency!
If I don't get the fluid link back, the four of us will die.
Daleks! The Thal people wish to live in peace. Let us work together to rebuild our world.
No! It's a trap! Get out of here! Run!
They are to be exterminated.
This senseless, evil killing...
I always wish I liked Doctor Who. I just can never really get there. I feel like there's just so much now that you could never really... Right, say if I've never watched an episode, I could never really sit down and go, right, what have I missed? I think it would just be absolutely weeks and weeks and weeks to sort of catch up. And
yeah. Well, I was sort of born in... I was in the wilderness years, so in 1989, five or something. So I never really saw it when it was on. I saw the 1996 movie with Paul McGann, those Peter Cushing Dalek movies, and got into it that way from old VHS and stuff. And I have watched all of the episodes ever made and listened to all of the soundtracks for the missing ones. I can't necessarily, I'm not an expert on it as much as Hancock, but I do rather enjoy a bit of Doc Who.
No, it sounds good. And I think other than the first series, I think all of it's now on iPlayer, is there? Well, say all of it.
Almost.
Everything that survives.
Yeah.
Almost everything that survives. There's a few things that aren't on there, but most of it's on there.
They've been promoting it recently, haven't they, between programmes, saying it's on the iPlayer.
Come with me.
I'm the Doctor.
Yes.
I'm a Time Lord.
When people need help, I never refuse.
Oh. We're just going on a little trip.
Where?
Wherever you like.
Is it always this danger?
Gwen.
Why? Watch it, Spider-Man.
Get it!
There are some corners of the universe which have read the most terrible things.
Discover the Hooniverse.
Where do you want to start?
I'm looking for the Doctor.
You've certainly come to the right place.
Fantastic!
Only on BBC iPlayer.
Yes, all dropped on there on the 1st of November with extra things being added and a few other nice little bits and pieces like movie versions with a new introduction with some of the classic Doctors like Sylvester McCoy, Peter Davison and Colin Baker. So that those are quite fun.
Last time Martin and I went to the Riverside Studios to see Edgar's Half Hour on the big screen, they had a big Doctor Who exhibition there. Did we mention this before? They had a
I think you sent TARDIS. Me various photos, yeah.
Yeah, they had a TARDIS and a Dalek and various photographs and stuff around and different bits and pieces, display stands. So, because a lot of the early shows obviously were made at the Riverside.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
In fact, there's an early one with the Daleks that's got the Hammersmith Bridge in the background, isn't it? And that might even be the one that's been colourised.
No, it's the sequel. Know.
That was a sequel, was it? Okay.
Didn't they say it was the first Dalek episode that they appeared from under Hammersmith Bridge? You might know.
No.
Well, you'll know better than me.
No, it was no, because the first Dalek episode is set on Skaro, and then the following year they did the Dalek invasion of Earth, and that's where you've got Daleks trundling down the bridge and past Nelson's column and things like that.
Of course.
Yep.
Of course.
But it's seven 25-minute episodes cut down into a 75-minute movie, the colourised version, because I think the pace is a little bit off from modern television, and trying to colourise that would take many, many more years, I suspect, of the stuff.
Yeah, so I've got to say, I knew it had to be edited as it was down to an hour and a quarter. So, and the next episode we're going to discuss on this Doctor Who podcast is...
Hey. I think I'm out, guys. I'm tapping out.
The Towns of Wing Chiang.
You think you've got the bill curve of your podcast for this? When you imagine what it would be like that? I didn't know anything about Doctor Who. I think I've seen a few episodes, but that's about it. Good God.
Well, if I can change the subject from vintage TV to vintage theatre, because being a bit of a culture vulture, I went to the theatre the other week in the West End. But what was quite interesting for me, it was a Noel Coward play called Private Lives. I don't know if you've heard of it, from 1930. And I love going to the West End Theatre. I love the actual buildings, looking round the theatres inside, you know, wonderful building. But what was quite interesting was that it was written by Noel Coward in about 1930, but actually the comedy is quite timeless. It stands up just as well. And it reminded me of the things we say about Hancock, you know.
I'm awfully glad we decided not to go out tonight.
Or last night.
Or the night before.
Well, there's absolutely no reason to, and we're so cosy here.
Exactly.
It is nice, isn't it, Elliot?
Yes, but it's an awfully bad reflection on our characters. I think we ought to be absolutely tortured with conscience.
We are, every now and then.
Would you be young always, if you could choose?
No, I don't think so. Not if it meant having those awful bull's glands popped into me.
Cows for you dear, bulls for me.
We certainly live in a marvellous age. Must be so horrible for the poor animals being experimented on.
Not when the experiments are successful. Why, in Vienna, I believe you can see whole lines of decrepit old rats carrying on like the Tiller girls.
Oh, darling.
Well, the interesting thing about a lot of Noel Coward stuff, I mean, Blythe Spirit is one that I've enjoyed the film versions of, and in fact the television version with Hattie Jakes as Madame Arcati, and that's fairly timeless because they're about people rather than topical events, as it were, I suppose.
Yes, it starred Nigel Havers and Patricia Hodge in the main roles. But, you know, we often talk about Hancock being the first sitcom or whatever, and the fact that before Hancock, radio and even TV programs, you didn't have this continuous drama for half an hour. And it was very much gag-driven, not character-driven, or you didn't get the comedy from the situation. But when you go back to theatre productions, they did have this, because this play is very much a theatrical sitcom. It's laugh-out-loud comedy. I mean, really, really laughing for the whole hour and a half. But all the comedy came from the situation and the characters. There were no actual jokes in it. And it made me think, you know, well, they had this... I mean, obviously, comedy has appeared on stage for hundreds and thousands of years. There's nothing new in that. But it just seemed odd that whereas a lot of stuff on radio had sort of transferred from the theatres and the music halls. It was quite novel in 1954 when Hancock started to have this sort of comedy drama on the radio.
I suppose maybe comedy plays per se would be longer form rather than a 25, 30 minute sort of sitcom format. So you maybe had comedy plays, but they were more an hour and a quarter, 90 minute type dramas with a bit of humour in, perhaps. Don't know. Wasn't listening to the radio in 1953, so I can't tell you. Not that old, I just look it some days.
I've been thinking about, I don't know if you ever, have you watched Goodnight, Sweetheart? I don't know why you,
oh,
you
love said that.
Noel Coward really,
yes.
First thing I thought of there was...
He appears in that.
Yeah.
Played by David Benson, who did the voice of Joe Walker.
Yeah. I really enjoyed it first time round, and it's been such a long time since I last watched it. I've got a real itch to go and rewatch it. And
that's exactly the same with me, Jones. I'm on the last episode now. I've just watched the whole thing from the start. Yeah.
Does that include the 2016 special?
Yes, I've watched that. Yeah. I thought that was excellent. When they redid it in 2016, I was so confident that they would make a new series.
I was really hoping they would. It's really disappointing.
Because it worked so well. It just worked brilliantly. So I don't know whether any of the cast didn't want to do it or whatever, but it was. I really enjoyed that.
I love Phoebe and Michael. All right, and you. I'm so bored. And I'm missing out on so much. In the 21st century, they'd probably landed on Mars, cured cancer, and achieved European unity. And I could get back. Get back to where I once belonged.
Oh, my God! When did you land?
Today, an hour ago.
How? No, it doesn't matter. It never made sense anyway. And it's your birthday.
You remembered?
Oh, every year Yvonne and I crack open a bottle of champagne and raise a glass to the best man we ever knew.
Really?
Of course not, you duplicitous egomaniac. You ran out on us.
I didn't intend to.
Go on, get in. Tell me everything.
I did hear that the cast were already up for it, but I think it was down to the BBC. I think it was just down to they didn't want to commission it. I thought they were using it as a bit of a test run, weren't they? I've heard.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
But I mean, I really enjoy the show, and I watched the whole run, I don't know, 10 years ago or so. And I think the only thing is having a sitcom which is about your lead character having an affair maybe is a little bit less PC now than it was back in the 90s. I think there's certain elements that make you think, oh, your lead character's a bit of a scoundrel. You know, perhaps that's a factor.
He only had one wife at a time.
And the two actresses were replaced, weren't they? Because the original two actresses left. So four wives, technically.
Yeah. At one point, I think his wife was alive still in the 90s. I think that was one of the episodes.
Oh, yeah, as an old lady or something in a care home.
No, I don't think it was. Oh, right.
I recall that. Yeah. Well, something like that.
Definitely Reg. Reg's grandson or son was definitely store policeman.
Yeah, that's true. I like the guy who played Reg.
Yeah, I did as well.
You see him occasionally in other things, but not very often. I suppose he's quite elderly now. But yeah, that's a good little series. Marks and Graham, wasn't it, that one? We were at the writers.
I don't know. But talking about Reg the policeman, though, I mean, it's a Bill Kerrish, isn't he, really? He's the dimwit in the team. Yeah.
I told you normal service would be resumed, didn't I?
You did, Gary. You were right about Cuba, just like you were right about Suez and the Berlin Wall and Skiffle. I never saw that coming.
Well, sometimes I get lucky, you know.
Oh, don't be so modest. You're a proper Gypsy Rose Lee.
She was a stripper, Reg.
Well, then the other one who tells your fortune over Petticoat Lane.
Gypsy Rose Levy?
That's the girl.
And then you've got his sort of dodgy mate who forges all the stuff on his printing press. Who's a bit of a Sid sort of... It is Lawrence Marks and Maurice Graham, who are the writers as well.
Yeah.
Who also read Birds of a Feather and The New Statesman. The New Statesman's good. I like that.
It went off at the... I thought it it started off well and then got worse in the as it went on. I think they about four series, didn't they? But I think the fourth series was quite poor. Mind you, I thought Goodnight Sweetheart went off midway through and then come back again for a triumph finish.
Sometimes happens. Yeah.
Started to drag in the middle.
I remember it being quite a big deal when the sort of final episode was showing. I remember a lot of talk about it.
Yeah. Similar with Red Dwarf. Red Dwarf had a series or two that seemed to go off the boil and then they came back a bit better.
No, and they came back
after a hiatus.
Yeah.
At this point, I feel like I must plug my brother's just doing a new podcast called The Three Comedos, and they discuss all things comedy from Red Dwarf.
Oh,
Bottom.
They followed me on Twitter. I didn't realise that was your brother.
Yeah, they're doing a new podcast. The audio is a little bit bad on the first few episodes, but it does get better. But I can recommend it. I did actually, I've listened to all of the episodes so far. They are very, 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 very funny. If you fancy something a bit lighthearted.
Three chaps sounds good. Chatting about comedy.
Yep, one for us to have a listen to.
We're better. Yeah. We've got one more chaps.
Yeah.
Well, the other one I've listened to recently is Goon Pod, which is a great, great podcast hosted by Tyler Adams. And he recently had the daughter of Harry Secombe on there for quite a lengthy chat, which was fascinating to listen to. Oh. Sort of Harry Secombe, and of course, lots of links to Tony Hancock with Harry. So that was a rather nice one to listen to.
If we're talking about podcasts still, just one I'm listening to, another one which I've been addicted to now for about the best part of 3 years, is called Chatterbix with Joe Wilkinson and David L, who co-wrote, I've been talking about it recently, about a sitcom on the Isle of...
Is it the one with our friend who was at the reunion dinner?
Yes, she was in it. Yes, that's right. The Cockfields.
The Cockfields, that's it.
Was Diane in that?
Diane Morgan's in the first series.
Yeah, she was in season one, yeah.
Oh, I didn't realise that.
She's really good at it as well. Really, really good. Chatterbix. It's very much almost... They originally billed it as kind of like a morning show. It was completely unscripted. So the second they come on, they had no idea what they're going to talk about. Some episodes are, by their own admission, bad. But I think that's the kind of the beauty of it, because you never quite know what you're going to get. Because at one time, they're doing them every single day.
It's a bit like us, James.
Yeah. I think doing John a disservice there, because they would literally record it and then not even edit it and just pump it out 20 minutes later. And it was daily. It's really, it's a good listen. They've got some really good guests on there. They've had sort of Ricky Gervais. They've had some quite serious guests as well. So they'll get like a Red Arrow pilot, or they'll have like a criminologist on to talk about various things. So they have some really interesting guests. They also have some really good actors and comedians and stuff on. And it's, if you get a chance, have a listen. It can take a little bit of getting used to, but if you find some good ones, it's good. It's really good. It's lighthearted. It's not too upbeat. It's just two blokes chatting, and it could be about anything. It could be about the weather. It could be about anything. I find it quite
interesting. Those sort of podcasts are quite good. There's one called Nice Things, which is one of our members, Michael Livesley, and his friend Paul Carmichael, who are two sort of actors who talk about various things they remember from the 70s television shows and things like that, which is quite fun.
Mm. That's a new spot, isn't it? Recommendations.
It is.
Segment.
New little segment.
Pod of the week.
Pod of the week, yeah.
And whilst we're thinking about Diane Morgan as well, I've been continuing to watch Mandy. I still haven't finished it, but how brilliant is that series?
Yeah. It's a good one. It's a very good one. And one more series to follow soon.
I won't say any more than one to stun, two to kill, three to make sure. And if any listener isn't aware of what that's all about, go to the first episode.
You will love it. So then I guess it's time for some Hancock headlines. What's in the news this week, Martin?
Well, regular listeners of this podcast will know the fabulous news that a lost episode of Hancock's Half Hour has been found. So I'll just mention it again briefly, because hopefully everyone will have heard the brilliant news that the episode A Visit to Swansea, which is the fourth episode of the second series, which is the only episode to star both Tony Hancock and Harry Secombe. We're looking forward to a broadcast of it on Radio 4 or Radio 4 Extra at some point next year. So as soon as we know the details, we'll make sure it's on the Tony Hancock Appreciation Society website. And obviously we'll make sure listeners know if we're doing any podcasts around that time. And of course, once we've got the date, and hopefully we'll get to hear the episode, because none of us have heard it yet, hopefully we'll be able to do a special podcast to analyse and have a look at it. Well, so really looking forward to that next year.
was reading the bit that says it's time for the scores. That's, I'm a bit far ahead there. 12T. Yeah.
Have we got any tweets and emails this week?
Nothing my end.
I've got a couple of things. Sorry, go on, James.
No, not interesting at all. I was just going to say I actually lost access to the Twitter account, but I managed to get it back this afternoon. I don't know why. She completely signed me out.
And we're these things happen.
Well, that's a strange one.
Very excited for the podcast, though. So, most excitement has happened on my Twitter feed.
You mean your X feed?
Sorry, yes. How dare I? Yeah. X feed, yeah.
The trouble is, when people talk about their ex, you think they're talking about someone they used to be married to.
A little bit.
I did a tweet recently about the missing page, and someone come back, the rock and roll guy. I think I mentioned him on podcast before. But what he said, that in his opinion, the missing page was Hancock's best performance. I mean, we often talk about what's your favourite episode, what's the best episode. And I thought this was slightly different, you know, in which episode is Hancock's best performance. Mm. And we got quite a lot of responses coming back from that. London Calling reckoned it was Radio Ham. Lily von Stuck and Rihanna both said it was 12 Angry Men. A couple of people, including Mark Sturton, went for the Bowmans. And one of our members, Pete Mercer, said, well, although we've only got the audio track, he quite thought Hancock's performance in the horror serial was the best, which was quite interesting.
And a couple of people went
for the lift. But I wonder what you guys think. You know, opposed to the best one or the favourite one, which is his best performance?
I mean, I think his performance of Terror, Sid putting the cold steel across his tonsils in The Two Murderers, is pretty good. And it's beautifully lit as well, which adds to that. And of course, the other great acting moment is where he's trying to remember someone's name in the reunion party, which is a tour de force of just thinking and gestures and all of that. Mm.
But that's more about a part of an episode, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, something within an episode. I was trying to think what I thought his best performance was, and I found it very difficult to say which episode does he perform best. But I think I'd probably come down on the lift, because I think from start to finish in an episode, he's at his belligerent best. And I think the Radio Ham as well is another one where it's a tour de force, isn't it? You know, from start to finish.
I think Missing Page for me. Missing Page is a great performance, isn't it?
Yeah. Made better by the mind.
Yeah, if you're looking at the visual side of, I think you're right. I think it's the Missing Page. But I do think for Tour de Force, it's got to be the Bedsitter. To be able to hold a half hour together on his own, I thought was an incredible achievement. And that worked so well from start to finish. So I think from a performance point of view, I think I'd go for the Bedsitter.
It's interesting that no one come forward with that one in the
it's interesting. Of course, if you're looking at the radio, because no one's mentioned the radio, I think I'd probably go for Sunday Afternoon at Home.
Yeah. Well, in fact, some people did say that. Yeah, it was quite interesting that although a lot of people were talking about TV, a number of people come back on radio episodes, and Sunday Afternoon at Home was certainly mentioned. In fact, Julian Dutton said, I thought Julian's reply was quite interesting. He said there are moments of genius in every episode, but some episodes are all genius. And he mentioned The Missing Page, Economy Drive, Wild Man of the Woods, Poetry Society. So, he was mentioning TV programs and radio programs of being total genius.
Sleepless Night is a radio episode that I find that I think is really strong throughout as well.
The Last Bus Home is another cracking one. Yep. But quite a lot of realism in that one, and I know I like the madcap ones, but realism ones are quite good now and again too.
It's the bus.
Hooray, it's the bus. Yeah. Great stuff. Well, a fun performance from Bill in that one as well. I mean, it surprises me really, because people were talking about what episode they liked the least, and a lot of people say the male suffragettes, because some of the elements of the humour are a little bit dated, shall we say. But some people said they really disliked Bill and Father Christmas, which I think is a wonderful episode. I mean, it's daft.
Great episode.
But it's great fun.
Yeah.
I can't see how that would be a least favourite for anyone. Mm. But there we go, each their own.
Oh, absolutely. It's all a very personal thing. But yeah, I think male suffragettes and possibly for me, The Chef That Died of Shame is the other one that doesn't really quite work for me. And I think part of that is because the chef ends up, as an alcoholic. So the chef ends up as a heavy drinker and sort of mirrors Tony's own life into the 1960s.
Yeah, but it was done at the height of his powers. So there's some wonderful lines in there, like, I'll go and find myself. You know, you should go out and find yourself. All right, I'll go and look in the Rose and Crown. I'm probably in there, which I love. Yeah, so it's a very subjective thing, isn't it, favourites?
Yeah, well, absolutely. And what one person's favourite is another person's really can't stand. So, yeah, no, absolutely. It's all true. A personal thing.
So then, I guess now it's time for our main subject, Cinderella Hancock. So this one, interestingly, I've got some notes here about three of the sort of guest cast that you have, because you've got, obviously, you've got Dora Bryan, who's known for her high-pitched sort of voice of playing sort of Dolph Bluses in various films like Carry On Sergeant, The Great Centurion's Train Robbery. She's also in The Green Man, which is a great Alistair Sim film.
Oh, that's a brilliant film. What amazed me when I looked up Dora is how many films she was in the 1950s. I counted up, it's about 40 films she was in. She must be getting on for equaling the number of films that Sid James was in the same period. Just an incredible, incredible filmography for her in the 50s.
It does show you how many films they were knocking out in the 50s, though, doesn't it?
Well, it does.
Yeah, absolutely. It does, yes.
And here she is, Miss Dora Bryan.
Always nice, isn't it?
Good night.
Here, where are you going?
Back to the dishes.
Oh, no, you're not. You're mine for the rest of the evening.
Well, it's very nice. Thank you very much. I won't trouble. I was expecting Jane Russell, you see, and I, well, you're a sweet girl. And I
yes, well?
Well, have a yashmak.
I want you. I want you, do you hear? I want you. Oh, that beautiful bushy black beard, it fascinates me.
Let me go and you can have it.
Well, what's the matter, Sheiky? Don't you like me?
Well, I don't quite know how to sort of how to put this, but no.
Well, she's in Old Mother Riley Meets the Vampire, which has Bela Lugosi in it, which I like a bit of Bela Lugosi, and also Hattie Jakes and Richard Wattis, which is quite a fun film, but daft as a brush. And latterly in the 90s and things, she was in Dinner Ladies and Last of the Summer Wine, I think possibly in the early noughties. So she was going for a good long old while, was Dora. But of course, you've also got in this one, you've got Adrian Waller as the announcer, who goes a bit beyond just announcing the show and breaking the fourth wall, speaking to the main character in the first couple of minutes.
It's very strange opening, isn't it?
It is.
I know we have, there's another episode. What's the other episode where the announcer does quite a bit? It's the
13th of the month.
13th of the series.
Robin Boyle in that one.
Yeah, yeah. But this one is even stranger, the way it's sort of scripted.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just an odd opening.
It sort of strikes me as a bit of a It's a Wonderful Life type opening kind of thing, you know, that it sort of almost like the introduction to a film with the announcer, someone explaining the situation once upon a time kind of thing, like you get at the beginning of some films.
The most fabulous things can happen to the most ordinary people, even to people as ordinary as Tony Hancock. Last week, he was walking through the park early in the morning, which wasn't surprising because that's where he slept the night before. Gaily, he makes his way along the crowded streets.
I can say, he's not only just doing that. Of course, he's actually interacting. He's not just commenting on what's supposed to be going on. He's interacting with Hancock as well. Particularly
yes, put
where
it
he's...
back. No, no, no.
Put it...
Yeah.
Only want one.
Well, we'll find out when you can't even whip a walnut for your breakfast.
Past the butcher's shop, past the post office, past the fruit barrows, laden high with... put it back.
Only want one.
Put it back.
He won't miss that little one there.
Put it back.
All right. Fine thing when you can't even whip a walnut for breakfast.
It's an incredibly busy episode, isn't it? It's a real whirlwind. Just because of the amount of characters alone, I thought there's quite some strange choices in there in terms of characters. Like, it feels a bit random. Like, where did they come from?
But it is good for us to review, I think,
an
episode from the first series, because you're right, it is a bit of a roller coaster, this episode, but it was towards, what was it, number 11 or something in the series?
I think
so. They were starting to get their feet under the table, really, weren't they, with the series? I mean, we've listened to, what is it, The First Night Party already, haven't we, in The Marriage Bureau from the first series. And we noticed the difference between The First Night Party at the start of the series and The Marriage Bureau at the end. And
yep.
how it sort of developed.
How the characters have evolved and that.
Yeah.
There was one of those trilogy episodes in this series, wasn't there?
The Hancock Festival.
The Hancock Festival, which was like a parody. But this was, apart from that, this was like the first real parody episode that they did, wasn't it?
I think it was. I just had a look. It was number 10 the series.
Yeah.
And what I thought was really interesting is this is obviously the first series, so the first time they'd been writing at Christmas. And this is, in the first series, this was the fourth Christmas-themed episode.
Mm. Well, there were a few.
You had Department Store Santa, then Christmas at Aldershot, then the Christmas Eve party, and then Cinderella Hancock. So they were certainly, Ray and Alan certainly went overboard with the Christmas theme within this particular series.
Well, I suppose the series started in early November, so they'd have a run of 20 or however would have been right over that Christmas month, wouldn't it? So it sort of makes sense. And I was going to say about Adrian Waller as the announcer, about 2019, his son, Michael Waller-Bridge, got in touch with me and provided some wonderful biographical information on Adrian for our missing page. Would you like to know Adrian's real full name? It's a long one. So he's Cyprian Chandos Richard Waller Waller-Bridge. Blimey. is his full name.
Excellent.
He started out as an actor and then he moved into directing and producing. He then moved to Toronto to work for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation in 1957. And produced quite a few things out there and sadly died of a heart attack, age only 42, in 1960. And of course, you know, his passion and with performance and production sort of was carried on through his grandchildren. So Isabel Waller-Bridge is a TV and film composer. You've got Jasper Waller-Bridge, who's a creative development director, and his most famous grandchild, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who is an actress, writer, and producer of such things as Killing Eve and Fleabag.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and also in the latest Indiana Jones film, although I've not watched that myself yet. So that's one on the to watch list. And the only other person who's sort of not normally in a Hancock is you've got Paul Carpenter as well.
Yes.
Who was also in The Boxing Champion.
I beg your pardon.
I'm very sorry, my fault. I didn't see you bending down there. Haven't hurt yourself, have you?
No, I'm all right. I was looking for something in the gutter.
You won't find any cigar ends down here. Not in this neighborhood. Have you tried Downing Street?
Now, look, you got me wrong. I just happen to have dropped something.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Well, I'd help you to look for it, but I haven't got time. You know how it is. Very busy man. Can't stop. What was it?
My wallet. It had 80 pounds in it.
Stop the traffic, road up, diversion, everybody off the street. That's it, all the cars around the back street. Put the notices up. That's right. Now then. Ah, that's a different proposition. Yes, the wallet. It's going to be very difficult to find it with all these people about. You realise that? It might take hours.
Paul Carpenter, he was a Canadian actor, also died aged 42, so there's a bit of a theme going here.
He died in a... Well, he died during a stage production, which was also starring Moira Lister.
Yes, that's right, yes.
It was during a rehearsal, wasn't it?
During rehearsals.
I think it was during a rehearsal, yeah.
I mean, yeah, it was during a production,
As a theatre that he was found in his dressing room.
After having a car crash, wasn't he? Yeah, he had a car crash like a week before or something. Don't know if that was related or not.
It's fairly shortly before, could be. But he originally sang, he's a singer as well. He sang with the Ted Heath on radio.
Yeah.
He starred in a radio show called Riders on the Range, which I imagine must have been a Western.
Yes, it was, yeah. He played a cowboy called Jeff Arnold.
Jeff Arnold. I'm sure that's referenced in the Hancock's Half Hour somewhere, you know, because I've heard the name before.
All these radio series in the 50s were hugely popular and very big audiences.
Mm.
So there was loads of things like that on every week that people listened to. There was one that Bill Kerr was in. What was it? The Flying Doctor. So that went on TV as well later on, but I think it was in the radio series that Bill Kerr was in every week.
Interesting. Yeah. And of course, Paul Carpenter had sort of claim to fame was in Goldfinger.
Yes.
I think he was escorting James Bond as an American general.
That was his last role, wasn't it? That was his final. I think it was even released after his death.
I think so.
I think it was his final. Yes, I think so.
Yeah. He was also in the film Dr. Crippen, which is about a famous murder. So that's quite an interesting one. I think he's got a slightly bigger role in there because he's not uncredited, unlike in Goldfinger.
He plays quite a rich man in this, doesn't he? Because when he turns up, he's got £80 in his wallet, which, using the very nearly an armful calculator, works out about $2,500 today. So not many people walk around with $2,500 in their wallet, do they?
Slightly less after he bumped into Tony because he only had £79 afterwards.
Yeah,
but not many people could count that much money with their toes either.
Well, what a coincidence. It's under my foot all the time.
Yes.
Who'd have thought it? Now, isn't that really amazing? Of all the places it could have been, it just happened. Yes. It just happened to turn up in the very spot where I happened to be.
It's fantastic. Yes.
Lucky I was here. I mean, you might have been searching all day.
Yeah, I know.
It's
very kind of you.
Yeah, £10, please.
Look, I just better check and see if all the money's there.
Well, it's all there. I counted it with my toes. Yes, £10, please.
Oh, I love that line.
Yeah, that's right. He's counting it with his toes. But I love the line where he could put a nice topical line that said, "What are you going to use it for? Are you going to buy a pound of tea? Going to buy a pound of tea?
Well, look, I can't give it to you just now. I need every penny of this £80.
What are you going to buy? A pound of tea?
I'll tell you what. You give me your name and address, and I'll see you get rewarded. All right?
And I looked that up, and it said there was a real shortage of tea.
In
1955. And the prices went up to 8d a pound. So eight old pence a pound was the price of the tea, and that's what it had gone up to.
Cool. Bleeding us dry, eh?
But then they were just thinking about the money. The reward was £10.
So that's a week's wages in the mid-50s, isn't it?
So that was a huge reward.
My grandfather used to say she'd earned £10 a week when he was a youth in the earlier 50s. So it's a big one. The thing I noticed about this one is that it's such a bawdy sort of episode. There's a lot of jokes here that are, you know, you're surprised no one went through with a blue pencil. You know, he's like, "Morning, Charlie, working?"
"Morning, Charlie, working?" "Oh, of course you don't have to, no." "No, got 28 kids.
"Oh, no, of course you've got 28 kids, you don't have to, do you?" Other lines like, you know, there's one from Sid of Ava Gardner slapped me in the spot waltz.
"How you been getting on, Sid?"
"Not so good, Billy. Ava Gardner slapped my face in the spot waltz."
"Why?"
"Wrong spot."
Oh, why? Wrong spot. You know, and Sid pinching Tony's backside as well. If you pinch me there again.
"Hello. Who's the new char? Plenty of meat on her, ain't it? I like them plump. Hello, my dear. You going to be nice to me?
If you pinch me there once more, I'll fetch this shovel right across your face."
"Oh, it's you, is it?"
"Yes."
I was going to say, Tony wants him to, saying he's going to dance next to Jane Russell, to which Sid says she'll be head and shoulders above you, to which Tony says, "I know.
I know.
I know.
I'll chance it. Come on, lads. Please let me go. It'll be the only chance I'll ever get of dancing close to Jane Russell."
"What, a little bloke like you? She'll be head and shoulders above you."
"I know."
That one normally flies over my head, I think, when I was a youth, but now I very much get it.
And then once Kenneth Williams is announcing all of the guests that are attending the ball, and it's Margaret Rutherford and,
Miss Ava Gardner and husband, Miss XYZ and husband, Miss Rita Hayworth and company.
Oh, Rita Hayworth and company.
Miss Jean Crane and husband. Miss Guinness Johns and husband. Miss Rita Hayworth and company.
She'd been married 5 times.
She'd had a few.
Mm. Who is Margaret Rutherford mentioned in there, though, isn't she?
She is. Well, Paul Carpenter was going to take Margaret Rutherford, but he goes, "Well, you can't really, can you?" So I don't quite know what that joke is. Maybe Margaret Rutherford wouldn't look great in a evening gown. Maybe that's the joke. I'm not quite sure.
"Well, it's lucky I came along. I'm just on my way to the ball myself, and it so happens that I have a ticket."
"You have?
Well, I was going to take Margaret Rutherford, but... Well, you can't really, can you?
Yeah, I wasn't quite sure on that one.
Because I looked her up and...
A middle-aged, dumpier lady.
Yeah, you know. But I thought maybe it's because she, at the time, she was, I think she was sectioned. I don't know if that was it.
Oh, was she?
Yeah, she was.
Oh, was she? Okay, well, that would explain that.
Well, there we go. I did wonder. Because it gets quite a laugh, I think, that line.
Yeah.
So there's a few that get quite a big laugh, and I'm like, I don't quite know why they find it so funny. It's nice that they do.
Yeah,
but...
there's loads of those. That's a really good, like, pause it and, like, get on Google quite a few times throughout that.
Well, quite a lot of that. I did have a quick peep at the script. The spot waltz was not in the original script.
Oh, right.
So the original was that he was doing the pally glide and was told he was too pally.
Hey. Oh, I think the spot waltz is a funnier joke.
The spot waltz is definitely a better joke. But that was with the original. And it isn't altered in the script. It hasn't handwritten, so that must have been a last-minute change.
Come out through rehearsals. Because there's a lot cut from the script. I mean, there's one particular exchange that I noticed quite early on. I've not read through the whole thing. But they start out by, you know, Bill's instructing Tony he's got to, you know, clean the house and do all of this.
Bit like the Italian maid, isn't it?
Yeah. And Moira says, and no sweeping dust under the carpet like you have been doing. I do not sweep dust under the carpet. Oh, yes, you do. From the front door to the kitchen. It's uphill all the way. That's right. Look what happens every dinner time. I have to prop my soup plate up. And Tony goes, oh, yes, I know, but... And then Bill carries on. I have to build a barricade of mashed potatoes to stop the peas rolling off. To which Tony then goes on, all right, so I may sweep a little dust under the carpet, but at least I do keep the place clean. And then, you know, they go on like this. And so there's a kind of a chunk of stuff there that's not quite funny. It's vaguely amusing, but not quite the rip-roaring stuff. So you can imagine why some of those got cut.
Look, you know the arrangement. I let you lodge here rent-free till you find a place of your own. And in return, you do all my housework. Now, go on. Wash the dishes, make the beds, scrub the floors, clean the grate out, wash the curtains, chop some wood, bring the coal up, make the fire, iron my shirts, clean my shoes, dig the garden and sweep the chimney.
Looks like I'm going to have a hard week.
Week? That's only till breakfast time.
I find there's quite some odd choices in terms of Kenneth Williams wasn't used a lot more. I felt like Kenneth Williams could be used a hell of a lot more. I think especially the tailor or in the is it not the fancy dress shop, is it, where Tony goes to get his costume or even... where Sid actually plays.
Because they use... Yeah, Sid plays Sid, the costume.
Sid
man,
starts
in
with sort of like a German-French accent, Moisha. But then gives up.
Yeah.
Gives up very quickly, doesn't he?
The script says it should be a... It just says Yiddish on the script.
Okay.
Right.
But what was really interesting, if you... Because as we said earlier on the podcast, this episode was remade in the third series, and I think it was remade when there was a script written... that was rejected, which I believe was the counterfeiter, and they had to reuse a script last minute. So if you have a look at the second version of this show, which sadly is missing and wasn't remade by the Missing Hancocks because there was an original version. But in that, the names of the stars are a little different, even though it was only a few months later. The tailor was played by Alan Simpson and not by Sid.
Yeah.
The bit where Alan and Tony do their usual little exchange, which they did in the first series, was dropped. But the big difference I spotted in thinking of Kenneth Williams is Snide appears in the remake. And it's a brilliant one. He comes in as Snide right at the very end. He is the soldier that is coming to check the shoe sizes.
Yeah.
And he says... How many people have you got in the house? Which Andre says, three if you count Mr. Hancock. Kenneth says, no, don't confuse me. No, what I mean is, how many men have you got living in this house with only 1 foot? No, that's wrong. How many feet have you got living here with no boots on? No, that's still not right. Now, what did the sergeant tell me? Now, look, I've got a foot here without a boot in it. I've got a boot here without a foot in it. I bet you're wondering how I became colonel, aren't you? What a fantastic little line from Snide.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
It'd be lovely if that episode was found, because Snide hadn't been invented, if that's the right word, in the first series, had he? So
that's right.
He'd come into his stride in the second, so they'd obviously written this in. So,
But the thing is, it's quite rapid fire, isn't there? There's lots of little one-liners and jokes that you could just, you know, could have been a Bob Monkhouse original kind of thing. So, because obviously he was known for his one-liners. You know, like, oh, well, you know, they pulled down my old house to build a slum.
A Hancock address?
Well, actually, I've just moved. They pulled down my old house to build a slum.
Which is a wonderful, a wonderful...
That's right. Yeah, there's some almost some... Almost some variety type jokes in here, aren't there?
This is far less sitcom. This is more of a sketch.
It is.
Themed around Cinderella Hancock, isn't
it? They really shoehorned a lot in. Like the, is it Ray or Alan playing, pretending to be Cary Grant in a little skit?
It's Alan.
Alan, sorry, doing...
Well, he's no, he's not Cary Grant. He's Errol Flynn, isn't
Errol
he?
Flynn. Errol Flynn. Errol Flynn, yeah.
You remember that scene where you had to jump out of the aeroplane? You know, I did that for you. You were in bed where they filmed it, weren't you? Oh, yeah, yeah, I was.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a lovely little moment with Alan as well.
I was never the star. I was a stand-in. I used to do all the dangerous stuff for blokes like you. No offence, of course. How's the yacht?
Doing very well.
Oh, nice vessel. Yeah. This particular film I'm talking about was about a bloke who captured Burma by himself.
I was a bloke, yeah.
Well, of course you were.
Yes.
I recognise the moustache. You didn't have one.
No.
That's right. This particular, do you remember this intimately? We were doing the scene where you jumped out of the aeroplane into the Japanese-held jungle, which was on fire thousands of feet below.
Oh, yes, yes, I remember.
You remember the scene?
Yes, yes.
You were in bed when it was shot.
Yes.
Well, I was up in this plane with the cameraman and the director sitting in the cockpit behind
me. When I listen to these sides with Alan now, I always pick up on the fact that Hancock uses his natural voice in these little sides. Do you remember Julian noticed that a while ago? We hadn't spotted it until Julian mentioned it. But also, there's another bit in the episode where he uses his natural voice, and that's when Sid says something to him about, I think it's after he said he would have been out of place at the ball or something. But anyway, Hancock says, thank you and goodbye, Sidney Jane.
Now, let's face it, Hancock. You'd be out of place at a do like this, wouldn't he, Billy?
Yeah, of course.
And if you got at this ball, people will laugh at you, and you're not used to it.
Thank you and goodbye, Sidney Jane.
And he says that in his natural voice.
An ad lib? That's not part of the script, I don't imagine.
Oh, I don't know. Might not be.
Might not be.
Have to check that.
But, I mean, there's some of the stuff with Alan, you know, where he's playing Errol Flynn. He goes, yeah, you were saying? What? Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's me speaking, isn't it? My turn. And then his way of going, yes. Oh, yes, yes, very adamant. I was adamant. Yes, you're very adamant.
Well,
those little bits where they're kind of... You feel they're kind of just trying to one-up each other slightly are quite fun.
You were resting up for the big alligator scene when I swam across the river for you.
That's right. You've got a good memory. You were saying?
Eh?
You were saying?
Oh, yes, it's my turn. Yes, but anyway, I told him straight I wasn't going to jump without a parachute.
Well,
I was firm about it, not rude, but firm.
No, yes, yes.
Well, you know me, I could be adamant.
Very adamant, yes, very adamant.
Pardon?
I said very adamant.
That's right, yes. I'm easygoing.
When you look at the script, I don't think all of Alan's comments were as scripted in this one as some of the other ones that we've looked at.
No, they're normally penciled in.
Yeah, that's right.
If
that's
at all.
What I notice, and bearing in mind, of course, it's from the first series, is that there's so many more gags in this than there are in the later ones. And there's just a whole, I mean, we've mentioned some of them already, but there's a whole stream of them right through the episode, isn't there?
Different
sort of...
Yeah, I've been scrubbing this dirty old copper all afternoon, but it's no good.
Yes.
I can't get his helmet clean.
Yeah, that was a great line.
I was just going to say that. That's a brilliant line, isn't it? Isn't that super?
How are you getting on with the washing?
Terrible. I've been scrubbing this dirty old copper all afternoon, but it's no good. I just can't get his helmet clean.
But I wonder, because, I mean, Ray and Alan started off writing jokes at however many shillings they were each. I do wonder if some of the little jokes that have come into this one hark back to those earlier days.
Ones he used to write for, was it? Roy something, wasn't it?
Derek Roy.
Probably got them out of the Gordon Simpson joke book, which is probably in a drawer somewhere.
Yeah.
I like the one where they're... When he says about a chap doesn't want to drive a saloon car all the time, he wants to go out in a sports job now and again. And he says to Moira, you're solid, reliable, dependable. Your chassis is in good nick. And she says, thank you, we don't want an AA report.
So I'm not good enough for you now, is that it?
No, of course not. I still like you, Moira, but, well, you know how it is. A chap doesn't want to drive a saloon car all the time. He wants to get out in a sports job now and again. I mean, you're solid, reliable, dependable. Your chassis in good nick.
All right. Thank you. We don't want an AA report.
Brilliant stuff. Brilliant stuff.
Well, that's another one that's a little bit on the bawdy side, I suppose, isn't it? Sort of,
yeah. Yeah. You know. Well, the most bawdy ones come with Dora, don't they? When she says, I may not be as good looking as Jane Russell, but you stand more chance with me.
Yeah.
Cheeky devil. I may not be as good looking as Jane Russell, but you stand more chance with me. Oh, come on, let's dance. I've never danced cheek to cheek before.
I mean, for 1955, that's a bit, yeah. Bit near, isn't it?
Well,
it,
she wants to dance cheek to cheek, doesn't she?
Yes,
oh, indeed. Yeah.
There's the wonderful bit, the best bit of Dora is where she's going, oh, gather me up into your big strong arms and rain down passionate kisses. You're playing hard to get, Tony's reply.
Oh, come on, Cheeky, don't let's waste time. Gather me up in your big strong arms, throw me across your white stallion and gallop off into the night with me. Across the burning sands, to your tent in the middle of the desert where we can be alone. Throw me down onto the cushions, and with your eyes smouldering with all the hot-blooded passion of the East, rain your burning kisses down upon my eager, inviting lips as I surrender my very soul to you.
You playing hard to get.
Let us throw convention out of the window.
I think that's the highlight of the whole episode, that little piece. That is brilliant.
That's pretty good fun, isn't it? It's pretty good fun.
It is, isn't it? It is.
Because, I mean, Tony's, this is, like, they've written him down. This is very much, he's the artful dodger type. He's a man of no fixed abode, sort of lodging with Bill, which doesn't necessarily stand up to episodes before or after this one, but there we go.
Yes.
Bit of a ne'er-do-well. But, you know, they kind of, you know, even when he goes up to the film ball dressed up and Moira comments, oh, look, he looks like Tony a bit, doesn't he?
Hey, Sid, look at this guy in the turban and the beard.
Yeah, who is he?
Looks like an Egyptian.
Could be. Shaped like a pyramid.
Well, he's certainly the center of attraction. Everybody's crowding around him.
Doesn't he rather remind you of Tony in build?
Oh, no. He's much better looking than Tony.
Well, how can you tell? That beard hides his face.
Precisely.
Hey, look, that stopped dancing.
Oh, yes.
So, oh, yes, he's much more handsome. How can you tell? He's got a beard covering all of his face. Exactly. You know, those little bits.
Well.
Now, of course, you've got another reference to Prince Littler in this one, like we mentioned in the last episode. Royalty will be there.
You mentioned that last week, didn't we? Yeah.
And, of course, Anna Neagle as well. Now, Anna Neagle wasn't royalty and didn't have Lady in front of her title, but she did play Queen Victoria in about three films, so that might be why young Victoria.
Well,
all the big stars will be there. Jane Russell, Ava Gardner, Shelley Winters, Jean Crane, Audrey Hepburn and Gene Simmons.
Yeah,
and
I've heard a whisper that royalty's going to be there.
Who?
Prince Littler and Anna Neagle.
I'd have to practice me curtsies.
And I think she was very popular, wasn't she, Anna Neagle? I think I looked up and she said she was voted most popular star of a few years earlier, 1949, I think. So it was obviously would have been very well known. I mean, there were an awful lot of stars' names in this.
Oh, yes.
Reflecting back to the audience of the day.
Oh, God, it took me ages, honestly, because I didn't know who most of these people were. I had to stop and go, right, write that one down. Who's that? No idea.
I know I know most of the names of the list of Hollywood stars of the 40s, but there's a few weird and wonderfuls that ones like. Fred Emney gets a name drop in this, and Fred Emney was in Hugh and I. He was a very rotund gentleman who often played sort of colonels with a big old cigar and a monocle. Very distinctive sort of character actor, comedian.
He was in The Italian Job, wasn't he?
He was.
With Michael Caine, yeah.
Yeah, he had a bit part in that. As one of the people who dump her parcel in the bin to set all the lights off.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think, didn't he work with Pinky and Perky as well?
He may have done. He may well
I
have done.
I think he did. I think he was on the Pink. See, that's claim to
I
fame,
I think you've got
it?
One over on us here, Martin. Oh. This is obviously a rabbit hole you've been down.
Well, the joke being to lay out a pair of Fred Emney's trousers to fit Tony, whereas Fred was a much more rotund gentleman. So
that's a good one.
Good one if you know who Fred Emney is.
Wait a minute. I can't go. I've got no clothes to wear.
Well, I know Fred Emney pretty well. Perhaps we could... perhaps we could let out one of his suits.
Thank you, thank you. I don't think we need to pursue that any further. Very nice.
Say, I've got it, of course.
What?
I owe you £10 reward money for helping me find my wallet. That should be enough for you to hire some clothes.
Yes, of course, that's it.
Do you think they've had a bit of a... Do you think they've been told by the BBC that they can't keep name-checking people and having a bit of a pop at them? Because that style does wear away. And I'm just wondering if there's a conversation where they're going, do you know what, you've gone a bit overboard here. Because it's literally Marilyn Monroe, it's everyone.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, because the script for the third series, there's some different names, but it name-checks as many people as this one.
Yeah.
So when they repeated it, they did repeat the style.
I think the whole basis of the episode is that they're going to a film ball. So it's all about film stars. So it's inevitable, isn't it? They're just going to rattle off the names of all the people who are there. I should, these people were so much in the public eye. Film stars of yesteryear, probably even more than they are today. Although they're better paid and everything today, they were hugely famous in those days. So I think they were fair game for a program like this.
Yeah. I'd imagine so.
I think so. I suppose the type of comedy moved from rapid fire sort of topical jokes to just sort of situations based on life that everyone can relate to day to day that don't need those sort of name dropping and things like that for a quick laugh kind of thing that you have in the earlier.
It probably made it easier to write, didn't it? You know, in the same way that if you do a parody. Like when you do 12 Angry Men or that sort of parody, you're following the plot of the original and you're just sort of putting in the lines, aren't you? And similar here, I think once you've got the plot of Hancock going to the ball and in Cinderella mode, then you can just whack all these jokes in and you've got a 30-minute comedy.
Do you think that I just feel like the. What was Paul Carpenter's connection to Ray Allen, Tony, or anyone? Do we know? Is it just right place, right time?
I think all his work was over here, and I think he was on the West End stage, and he did a lot. All those films that we mentioned early on were all British films, so I think he was quite well known in theatrical circles and would have been known to producer and Hancock even. I don't know.
Getting a Canadian or American style into a British product means you could sell it overseas more potentially.
Yeah.
Also, just having the thing of, in The Boxing Champion, that's a very American type pastime, I suppose. So you've got an American character in there and you've got an American in this one, or a Canadian in this case, of course. So, yeah, maybe it's just a bit of colour.
I think that cowboy on the radio would have helped him, because I think he was probably hugely well known because of that. And once you've done one thing on the radio, then, people like Hancock and Gordon Simpson would lapped up all that sort of stuff back in the day. I can imagine them getting him in to do things.
Of course, the other name that's name dropped isn't a film star. It was Philip Harbin.
I say, Bill, have you seen that Turkish gentleman dancing with Dora Brown?
Yeah, he's quite a boy, isn't he? With that flowing white robe and bushy black beard, he looks like Philip Harbin standing up in bed.
Tony looks like Philip Harbin standing up in bed with his flowing white beard. And I think he was a celebrity TV chef of the day.
He was a chef, wasn't he? Yeah.
Yeah. And so they're not just film stars that they're name-checking in this one.
Oh, no. And name-checking a few TV shows as well. I mean, there's a thing of they talk about Moira. Well, she's on a panel game now. She'll be elevated to the peerage next year.
Anyway, you're on a panel game now. You'll probably be elevated to the peerage next year. You won't look at me then. Ah, but what does it matter? I'm not going to the ball, so why talk about it?
And, of course, she was on Find the Link, which was a 50s panel show that was about the guests trying to find the link between to a particular person or something, as I understand. So she was in 16 of those.
Glad you found that out, because I couldn't find that one out.
I couldn't find it either.
Let's talk about Aldershot, which is where he's, spoiler alert, being escorted back to because he deserted 7 years ago. But it's a night, we never get any consistency, of course, across Hancock's half hour. But 2 weeks earlier, he'd been posted to Aldershot in Christmas at Aldershot and had run away because all the soldiers were going to, well, he wasn't very well liked because of the poor quality of his cooking. Then discovered his in-laws were coming to stay for Christmas and decided he was going to go back to Aldershot. So I thought there was a nice little connection there that actually two of the Christmas episodes have got this sort of military connection with oh. the Aldershot barracks.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, is it comfortable, sir?
Oh, yes.
You're sure?
Yes, very comfy, a perfect fit.
Good. Martin, we have Aldershot barracks. You're under arrest.
What for?
According to our record, the owner of these boots deserted 7 years ago. All right, quick march.
Now, look, I can explain. I didn't desert. It was all the others. They were advancing the wrong way. No, take me back. Bill, Sydney, come on.
I do feel like the Cinderella theme was kind of shoehorned into the plot a little bit. It feels like it's a bit, let's make it like Cinderella. Let's call it Cinderella Hancock. Was it originally called Cinderella Hancock when they sort of labelled it?
No.
What did they label it?
No.
They, I suppose they've just sort of hung the theme of a film ball and just made it. I mean, it's referenced of like, you know, doesn't Tony say at one point, I'll go and get some pumpkins and a turnip or something, you know, for his carriage.
Some mice.
Oh, it's definitely a reference to Cinderella.
Taking
and
the Mickey,
and the shoe at the end of it and everything.
Yeah.
It's all that.
It's now me boot.
At last, me luck's changed. I'm going to the ball. Ava, Jane, Marilyn, cheer up, girls, I'm coming.
And Cinderella was the poor girl, Skivvy, wasn't she? And wanted
That's
to
right.
go to the ball. So it's definitely the story.
It's, you know, we've had the three Christmas episodes, now we've got a pantomime episode.
Yes.
To finish off the sort of the seasonal episodes in this series, I think, it's, as you say, very definitely Cinderella-based as a story.
Saucy version.
It's just such a random end, isn't it? When he's charged with deserting. You know,
it wraps up very quickly, doesn't
it? Yeah.
Well,
very quickly indeed. And like you say, Kenneth's not got much to do other than play the occasional butler and, you know, military man.
Well, this army boot was handed in to us last night by a lady, Miss Dora Bryan, who begged us to find out who the owner is. We'd just like the three men here to try it on, see if it fits any of them.
Certainly, Corporal. No, much too big for me.
Now you, sir.
Right. There.
It's quite a good fit.
I got both feet in it.
Well, that just leaves you now, sir.
Oh, yes. There. Hey, it fits. Surprise, surprise.
But then if you look across the first series, Kenneth did have less to do to
start
with.
That's true. He didn't have his recurring characters by then, did
he? No, that's right. No, he only played Lord Campion, is it, in the first episode? He doesn't do
Gerald
that much
Campion.
Lord
Bayswater.
Gerald Campion. Lord Bayswater. That's right. That's right. Gerald Campion played Coat Sleeve Charlie, didn't he?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. I mean, I suppose the thing is, as well, of course, Kenneth played maybe he played it as American in the remake, but he played the character played by Paul Carpenter in the third series version, I believe.
Yeah. Kenneth played the character by Paul Carpenter. I love there's a couple of comments about Tony and his career. And Tony jokes, says, oh, if you put a brush on my head when I sleepwalk, I'll whitewash the ceiling. To which he says, I was only being funny. You'd be out of a job if I didn't.
Yeah.
Or if
Bill
I wasn't.
Tells him, don't be funny.
After that, you can clean the silver and wash the bedclothes, scrub the carpet.
Now, wait a minute. Can I make a suggestion?
What?
Look, I walk in my sleep. Why not tie a brush to my head? I can whitewash the ceiling at the same time.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. I think that's...
I was only being funny.
Well, don't.
You'd be out of a job if I didn't.
Yeah, don't be funny. You'll be out of a job. And then later on, Sid says, if you go to this ball, people will laugh at you. And you're not used to it.
Yeah.
Two lovely little comments about Tony's career.
The first one you think is an ad lib, but it is fully scripted in the episode, isn't it? In the script.
It is.
So,
yes.
And I imagine the second one as well. So they were quite good at doing those almost asides that you're meant to think is an ad lib. But I suppose later they wrote for Frankie Howard, so they're quite used to that type of writing where something's meant to sound off the cuff.
Yeah. But as you say, there's very definitely the Cinderella references. The little line that says, you don't want me to go to the ball because I'm more beautiful than you are.
And I did so want to go to the ball.
Well, you're not going. There. I've torn your ticket up.
You mean beast. You don't want me to go to the ball, do you? Because I'm more beautiful than you are.
Which, of course, was originally would have been addressed to the Ugly Sisters.
Yeah. who are Bill and Sid in this situation. I can imagine they'd make a pair of ugly sisters, wouldn't they?
They would do well. They would do well. And, of course, then the army boot left on the stair.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, come back. Oh, come back.
Can't stop. Got to get back to the shop. Good night.
Oh, dear, he's gone.
I say, Miss Bryan, that sheik left in a hurry, didn't he?
Yes, and I don't know how to get in touch with him again.
Didn't he leave his card or something?
No, he just left this on the staircase.
What is it?
An army boot.
Instead of the golden slipper or whatever it is in Cinderella.
Glass slipper, isn't it? Yeah.
The glass slipper, that's right. That's right.
Put four wheels on it and I could have driven it home.
Yeah.
That's a lovely line, isn't it?
Another a reference to Tony's massive feet, where he was only, what was he, at 5.5, 6? I can't remember. You've told me before, Tim.
7, I think. I think
7 or 8. Yeah. It's quite small feet, really.
Yeah.
This fat little sheik hairs out of the ballroom so fast he leaves one of his boots on the staircase.
Huh? What happened to it?
We don't know. I think they handed it in somewhere.
Well, that sheik's got the biggest feet I ever saw. The size of that boot. With four wheels on it, I could have driven it home.
I was going to say, one or two references to Tony's size as well, like when he's going to get his costume and he's measured and Sid calls out, do you need the bell tent?
We should get the bell tent.
Yeah, but... yeah. And then when he's actually at the ball, I come over and Sid or Bill says, looks like an Egyptian. He looks like a pyramid. Two very definitely references to Tony's size in this one.
Cheap laugh and they worked.
So you want to hire a costume, ain't it? All right, then, other measurements. Where's the tape? 42 and a half inches. Yes, I think we've got a head to fit that. Now then, chest 16, waist 48, hip 63. I got just the thing for you.
What?
Moshe, the bell tent.
Wrap it up.
And remember, all this club has got to be back in the shop by midnight. Otherwise, you've got to pay rent for another day.
Midnight. I remember. Taxi?
Well, the one I like is the reference to the size of his fat head. Because... there's a thing where Moira dresses him up of like, oh, we are. Put this rag over you. It's like a cape. Put this bucket can be your top hat. Moira, I'm worried. Why? It fits.
It fits.
which is rather nice.
What, here in this dirty old kitchen?
Not a dirty old kitchen. A magnificent ballroom. Come on, let's dress you up. Put this bucket on your head. There. That's your top hat.
Moira, I'm worried.
Why?
It fits.
There's a reference, well, Tony makes reference to doing the Charleston dance, which is a contemporary dance in the 20s. But
Charleston.
Thing that's mentioned a couple of times, and I think it's actually mentioned in another episode by Hattie Jakes. I can't remember the episode, but she's going, Charleston, Charleston, da-da-da-da-da. And it was, I want to say, Americans Hit Town. That's it.
I think.
And also, but there was also a documentary about Hancock, which is screened quite a few years ago now, and there was some footage that was missing, and I can't remember what it was for. I should have done a little bit more research on this, I think, where he was doing that Charleston dance or saying Charleston. It's a kind of a reoccurring theme for Hancock.
Yeah, it was a popular dance. Mm.
Well, in the 20s, though, but it would have been sort of 30 years before.
Yeah, probably not quite so popular in the 50s.
No.
I just love the fact that he's doing the Charleston and everyone else is doing a waltz.
Keep to the near side, except when overtaken.
Oh, the log is singing on high. Oh, isn't it lovely? As I waltz around the room with you, I feel everybody staring at us.
I don't doubt it. I'm doing the Charleston.
You are a beautiful dancer. You just glide across the room. My feet don't seem to be touching the floor.
No, I'm not surprised. They've been on mine since we started.
There was a documentary. It was on TV about, I don't know, probably about 5 or 6 years ago, and they found this footage, and he was in a lighthouse. He was doing a skit.
Yes,
in a lighthouse.
That would have been... that was the documentary, The Unseen Hancock, produced by Victor Lewis Smith.
Yes.
Because they mentioned Charleston.
Lighthouse Keeper.
And I think I've mentioned to maybe John before, privately, about, oh, is this to do with when Hattie Jakes mentions a Charleston? But it's just funny that it pops up again.
It's going to be a dirty night. What does it say on that barometer? Property of the Strand Palace Hotel. It's no good. I can't stand it any longer. Charleston, Charleston. Having a bit of a dry spell, aren't we?
The other Dancy reference is the Lancers. You know, why? Why is it something about the Lancers? Why? I use a real lance. There are a few little jokes like that. You were going to say something, weren't you, Tim? I can't remember.
I was just going to take us back a bit when we were talking earlier about the repeat of this episode and the fact that the counterfeiter had been planned for that week. And I know there are various theories going by about why the counterfeiter was rejected. I have to say, I don't subscribe to any of them. I think on the BBC Sound, when they introduced the counterfeiter by the missing Hancocks, Neil Pearson puts forward two possible explanations. One, that Gordon Simpson thought that it gave too much prominence to Bill.
Yeah.
And secondly, that Hancock didn't like the criminality in the counterfeiter and said the only time that he would do anything wrong is when he was stitched up by Sid James.
Mm.
But in fact, I don't think either of those hold up. I'm not sure who originally came forward with them, because for a start, Hancock
they're
wasn't...
plausible theories, but they...
Well, Hancock wasn't jealous of other performers, and everyone who was interviewed, who worked with him, has always said he was very generous and would give lines to other people. He was just a generous bloke all round. He wasn't the sort of type. And in fact, Gordon Simpson said he didn't come in and count the gags like some comedians do. He wasn't that sort of bloke. But even if it was felt that it gave a bit too much prominence to Bill, because there is a scene in it that's 5 minutes long featuring Bill and Sid that Hancock is not in. But there are other scenes in Hancock's half hour that are nearly as long. This might be the longest one, but even at the start of Wild Man in the Woods, they talk about him for quite a bit before he actually comes on.
Yep. And in fact, in the student prints that we did last time.
But I think actually that if that was the issue, they could very easily have rewritten part of it. They could have cut down that 5 minute piece and shoved the bit in somewhere else. And similarly with the criminality, I mean, what happens is that Bill has got all this counterfeit money that he's been printing for Sid, and he's got it stashed in his bedroom. Hancock goes in and finds it and says, oh, well, Bill owes me all this money for rent. I'll take that. And he goes off and spends it and ends up getting in prison for it. But all it needs is a quick rewrite to say that Bill gives him the money and say, here's the money I owe you, Tub, for the rent. And then it's all legal.
And Tony's character in Progress before Hancock's half hour had a vague element of seedy criminality.
Oh, absolutely.
He was more like the Bill or Sid character in Calling All Forces. And in certain episodes of Hancock's Half Hour, he's happy to break the law if it's to his advantage. So,
And in actual fact, he does in this episode, because the £80 turns into 79.
Yeah.
Oh, it's only a small fiddle.
A very small fiddle,
doesn't
but
count.
It is still a fiddle.
Yeah.
So I think the reason that this one was redone was not actually to do with the counterfeiter being in any way rejected, because it's even as Neil Pearson said, you know, it's a really good script and it stands up well against all the other episodes. My personal theory is I sort of turned it on its head in my mind and said, well, one of the things about this episode when it was first broadcast, that it got really good audience ratings and the feedback they have from what we now call focus group was very good. Everyone loved it. And I think what might have happened is that during the second series, Dora Bryan might have become available at some stage. And they said, why don't we do it again?
Because was the third series one broadcast around Christmas? So it would have been a Christmas-themed episode. Perhaps they needed something.
Yeah, absolutely. So for the third series, you have The Trial of Father Christmas on the 21st of December, Cinderella Hancock on the 28th of December. So again, pantomime season.
Yeah.
And then the New Year resolutions was on the 4th of January.
Yeah.
So if you like three seasonal episodes again in the third series, because of course the second series would have been in the summer.
So
I think that it's probably something like that. They probably thought this was more suitable at that time. Dora Bryan might have become available for whatever reason. They might have met her somewhere. And she said, oh, I'd love to do it again. And, you know, that sort of thing. I can't see any logical reason for putting the counterfeiter in the bottom of a drawer. And I think that having got ahead for a week or two, I think the boys sort of forgot about it, basically.
It could well be. I mean, unless there was some kind of scandal in the news about counterfeiting and it was felt in poor taste to do a comedy show on the same subject.
I think
subject
we'd have known about
week,
it if that was the case.
You'd think so, wouldn't you?
And I think Gordon Simpson would have remembered it as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I think so. So it's a story we won't really probably know the answer to, but...
No. Love to hear that if the other one was recovered at some stage, wouldn't that be good to hear that with Kenny doing his snide voice?
Yeah, compare the two performances.
Oh, yeah. Wouldn't it just? Yeah, and Alan doing his, you know, foreign accent as a tailor.
Oh, I don't know. I'd imagine he'd have played it in his usual Alan Simpson way of all having the same voice.
Not according to the script. It says the same accent
says
in the script.
The same sort of accent. Yeah,
accent in the script as for the first series. So, yeah, but love to hear that. That would be... But, yeah, as you say, there's lots and lots of risque comments. The other one that I think we haven't mentioned was Moira, who says, "My agent says I must be seen in all the best places." To which Tony says, "With that dress on you're wearing, that should take care of that." I mean, that was, again, very risque for 1955.
I couldn't make that bit out. I had to rewind it a few times. I don't know if it's a recording.
He tails off as if he's like, "Oh, well, I better not talk about that." You know,
better not quite finish saying that.
Deliberately.
I don't want to go out and leave you here all by yourself.
Oh.
But I've got to. My agent says I must be seen in the best places.
Well, that dress you're wearing should take care... Yes. All right. I see what he means. Well, if you've got to go, I suppose you've got to go. I don't mind being left here on my tod.
Don't be upset, Tony. I'll stay with you as long as I can.
But all those risque lines couldn't have got any complaints because they were all in the remake script.
Yeah.
Well, people, we like a bit of saucy humour. I mean, it strikes me that the sauciness, bawdiness of this episode sort of like makes is sort of quite like a carry-on. So, you know, had Ray and Ellen not had much more successful careers, they could have been penning carry-on films for years and years, couldn't they?
Yeah, it's definitely got that feel to it, hasn't it? What's interesting about the two different scripts is that although we've talked about lots being cut, and this is quite a long episode, I think...
29 minutes, 40 seconds, something like that.
But the bits in the original script that are crossed through don't reappear in the remake script. But some of the other items in the script that clearly aren't in the version we've got are still in the remake script. So whether or not there is a longer version of this first series episode with some of that material in, I don't know. But perhaps they left that in because, of course, they took various bits out from the remake script, like the Alan and Tony talking heads piece.
Yeah, the monologue.
And if there is a longer piece of this episode, it might be sitting in somebody's loft.
Maybe. I mean, I don't expect... I mean, because all of the first series exists because the transcription services made copies of the master tape to make their transcription discs. And I assume maybe their master tape version of this, or at least the unedited earlier discs existed, and that's where the longer episode comes from. But for 29 minutes and 40 seconds, maybe they could have squeezed another minute in, but that's about the most. And it's a 37-page script, so it's a minute a page with that sort of spacing. So it had they recorded the whole thing, you'd have a 37-minute-odd episode, wouldn't you, lengthwise? So that wouldn't have fit the time slot.
No, and when you look at Wilmot, Tony Hancock, Artiste, for the transcription service for the first batch, the original issues that were on these 16-inch discs, it doesn't tell you how much was they were edited down, whereas subsequent ones say they were edited down to a certain length. For these first series ones, it doesn't mention whether there was any edits to them. Although if you look at all the scripts start with, "This is the BBC Light Programme," which of course isn't on any of the surviving episodes because that was removed for the transcription service version.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because you'd think, well, maybe they edited it a little bit, but not by much, necessarily.
One thing I did notice is when Tony is saying that he's very poor, Moira says, "Well, you shouldn't be, with that amount you're earning." And he says, "Well, I'll put it in the bank, but I can't get it out because it'll cost me tuppence
for every check.
I mean, I can't help being poor. We haven't all got money.
Well, you should have. You earn enough.
Yes, but you know how it is these days. By the time I've put it all in the bank, there's nothing left.
You've got money in the bank. Why don't you draw some out?
Not likely. A check costs tuppence.
Well?
I'd be overdrawn before I got my pen out.
Be overdrawn before you even got your pen out.
Absolutely. So that was the old, I mean, for younger listeners, that was stamp duty was payable on checks, every single check. And it was a penny on each check. I think it came in the late 1700s and went up to tuppence in the late 1919, around that sort of time. And I remember when I first started working in a bank that the old checkbooks in the drawer still had a stamp duty amount on them. And I want to remember, I think it used to be sixpence on a check, but that might
so that was like a tax. You mean it's a tax, really, a stamp duty? Is that what you mean?
It's a tax on every single check you issued. You had to pay taxes to the government for issuing the check, so it was a stamp duty on checks.
So there it wasn't bank charges.
It was taxed to the government. Every check you issued came with a fee, not a bank charge fee. Yeah.
Don't let Chancellor hear that, Martin. He'll bring that back.
Oh, who writes checks these days, though? Very, very few of us.
A lot of their members do.
Well, yeah, I used to, you know, up until about 5-10 years ago, occasionally I'd get the checkbook out, but not much call for it these days.
Yeah.
Not since they shut all the banks, anyway.
I haven't had a checkbook for over 10 years, and I can't remember when I had.
I haven't used a check for, God knows, 15 years.
Very occasionally I get a check now, and these days you photograph it with your phone and your online banking and you don't even have to give them the check. They just take a photo and you tear it up and put it in the bin.
Yeah, that's it. Very easy these days, isn't it?
Except when you've got a batch of them.
Well, that's probably true.
Yes.
So then I guess it's time for the scores. So what do you think you're going to give that one, James?
Well, it's a interesting one for me because it's not one of my favourites, but I did quite enjoy listening to it. There's loads and loads and loads of great one-liners. There's lots of topical references and cultural references, which you know I love. And I did a lot of fun sort of Googling these people and, you know, what was going on at that particular time to get a random laugh from the audience at certain points of the show. It's not one of my favourite ones. I do feel like the story is, the Cinderella side of it is shoehorned in, and I feel like the story could have happened without it being any relation to Cinderella at all. He could have just been doing the housework. He didn't have to be back by midnight. And therefore, I feel like a lot of the characters were shoehorned in. Sort of Sid is playing another tailor when he sort of starts off with an accent, should I say. And then kind of gives up in the second part of it. Yeah, I think I'm going to go with 6. I think it's really good. It's not my favourite one. I just get quite confused by it. I just don't really know where it came from. It feels like, I don't know, it feels like it's an amalgamation of so many different ideas and so many contributions. It doesn't feel, just to me anyway, pure Ray and Alan. This doesn't feel like it. I know it's a series one, so you get that very different style of writing than you do in the later series. Like, you can't compare this to something like The Blood Donor. You can't compare it to A Sunday Afternoon at Home because it's just a completely different show. And I do struggle sometimes with the series one with, I feel like, I know this is going to sound really negative, it's going to sound like it feels like overacted slightly by Tony.
It's very heightened, isn't it?
I can't get away from that sort of, that kind of that emphasis on his breathing when he's talking and when he's delivering his jokes. There's great lines in it, and I listened to it, and I did enjoy it, and I have laughed, but I just can't compare it to many of the shows. And I think that the trouble with Ray and Alan is they just set the bar so high with so many of their episodes, so many, that when you get one that you just don't, it doesn't hit you in the same way. It really, really tells me. So personally, I'm going to have to say 6. Sorry, I know it's quite low, but I've got to put some of them low. We can't all be 9s and 10s.
Exactly. What about yourself, Tim?
Well, I think I go with a lot of what James said there. I mean, again, it's not one of my favourite episodes. It's not one I sort of go to and play very often, I have to say. Having said that, I was really pleased that we're doing an episode from the first series, because generally speaking, I quite enjoy the Moira episode, series one. even though they're an absolute mile away from Sunday afternoon at home and Fred's pie stall and stuff later on. But I think, you know, I like listening to comedy of different types, and I sort of recognise that it's somewhat older than that, and it was earlier in the process and all that. I mean, I'm one of those few people who likes the first series of Blackadder.
Yeah, I like that.
A lot of people, yeah, I mean, a lot of people say, including the cast, they don't hold it in high regard, but I do. I love Moira as an actress. I think she comes across so well in all these things. She doesn't have a lot to do in this one. The fact that it's just bombarded you with jokes, really, from start to finish, isn't it? Very gag-driven.
Well,
but to me, they're great fun, and you chuckle all the way through it. There's all the gags about the actresses and, you know, the gags with Dora and that, and about, you know, playing hard to get and all that sort of stuff are very funny. Dora is a great character. I mean, her voice is just superb. And obviously, she was very well known when she did this anyway. She was a big star to have on. And it just makes it, you know, to have a special guest star like that in a program like this, you know, just makes it that much special to me. But again, like James, look, I can't give it a high score. I'll go one above James and give it a 7. Because it does make me chuckle all the way through, and I can't say that I dislike it. But on the other hand, it's by no means their best. And as James said, you know, you can't compare it to Blood Bone or Sunday Afternoon and that sort of stuff. There's no comparison, but it's a good bit of fun. I enjoyed listening to it a few times in preparation for this podcast, and I've enjoyed chatting about it tonight. Yeah, so it's a 7 from me.
And yourself, Martin?
Well, I think I'm going to go with Tim's score of 7. It's a very different sort of episode. I mean, clearly, it was Ray and Alan saying, okay, we've got past Christmas, now we're going to do a pantomime episode. And for what they've done with this, I think it's very well put together as a pantomime episode. But as a pantomime, it isn't, I mean, there is a little bit of a plot. But as you say, a lot of the laughs come from the gags rather than the situation, which is what you would normally get. And I hadn't mentioned it earlier, but one of the lines that got cut from the script is Tony talking to Paul, says, everyone's gone to the ball except me. They won't let me go. I've got to stay home and do all the chores. To which Paul says, what chores? To which Tony says, shall I? Yes, it's a pantomime. Double whiskey, please.
Oh, what chores? Hey.
Yeah, so it's full of these amazing old-fashioned corny gags.
Yeah.
Very much in a variety type of feel. So it almost feels like a hark back to Tony's earlier days on the radio with Calling All Forces and that sort of thing. It's much more of a gag-driven episode.
Well,
like you, though, James, I have enjoyed listening to it. It's not one that I would normally say, or if I'm going to listen to Hancock, it's not one that I would normally go and pick up. Having said that, I would really love to hear the remake that is lost, particularly as it's got Ken doing Snide and Alan doing this little Taylor's voice. I think it would be lovely to hear it. But one that only comes out occasionally for me, 7 from me.
See, I think I see where you're coming from. I mean, it would be lovely to hear that other version, because some of the lines that were cut from this one may have been included in that one, as you say. I think the rapid fire corny gags, and I do love a corny one liner. They're very Bob Monkhouse, you know, Bob Monkhouse, some of his jokes are like, you know, oh, I'm not afraid of death. Problem is, so stiff the next day, you know, things like that. The rapid fire, I just love a saucy joke. What can I say, really?
Well,
I wouldn't say it's necessarily worse than, say, the Blood Donor or the Sunday Afternoon at Home. It's just a different kind of humour and a different kind of comedy.
It's
and
very
I
different.
Of, yeah, I do appreciate the daftness and the one line. It's not so much for Ken to do in this one, but you've got your guest cast who do quite well, you know, with Paul Carpenter, Dora Bryan, and a slightly expanded role for Adrian Waller. So I think I'd give this one an 8 overall. It's got some lovely little moments where, say, Tony's imagining being at the ball of like, oh, look at all them smiling faces, that row of cracked plates over there. I'll just go and say hello to Jimmy Edwards. What, the brush standing up in the corner, you know, the broom. So those little bits are quite nice.
My word, what a distinguished gathering we have here. Mr. Jimmy Edwards over there, I see.
Where?
That broom in the corner.
Ah, what a charming array of smiling faces.
Smiling faces?
That row of cracked plates on the dresser. Get the pudding basin out.
Why?
I want to say hello to Vic Oliver.
Get the pudding bowl out. I want to talk to Vic Oliver. I don't know much about Vic Oliver, but I imagine he had a large, bald head. So, yeah, I think an 8 for this one for me, because although it's not necessarily a great, you know, standard episode of Hancock's Half Hour, there's been an awful lot of interesting things to talk about with this one for me. So,
agreed.
I think it's a cracker.
And I think what you're saying there was very interesting, because that's a very sad little sequence, isn't it? Tony can't go and he's having to pretend. And it almost points to the poignancy in that you sometimes will see then in Steptoe in later years. You don't see that as often in Hancock's Half Hour.
That's true. And you get a little bit of the, I wish I could go to the ball, and that sort of sighing breathiness and the very arch way it's sort of played, very over the top. But it's fun for that, I think. So, a good episode with some good stuff for most of the cast. And as you say, Moira is a great actress, and it's lovely to hear her slightly sarcastic. I think the only one who, you know, came close to that later was Hattie Jakes, who was very much in the Moira mould of someone who wouldn't take Tony's nonsense for very long. So I suppose that's an average of about 7 points. So that's very nearly an awful. So I suppose that's about it for this week. If you want to take it away, Tim.
Why not join us in the Tony Hancock Appreciation Society today? You can find us at tonyhancock.org.uk for all the information you need on how to join.
For just £13 a year, you'll have access to the members area of our website and receive 4 magazines a year by email, packed with information on Tony, his shows, and archive material.
Members also get a digital-only bonus pages supplement every quarter.
Or you can have full-colour printed copies of The Missing Page posted to your door for £16 a year in the UK or £26 worldwide.
We're a friendly and welcoming bunch, so please do join. We have reunion events with archive displays, guest speakers and special screenings.
Please do get in touch. We'd have questions, conundrums and feedback. To do so is very easy. Send your emails to podcast@tonyhancock.org.uk.
And keep an eye on our Twitter accounts for the latest news on the podcast and all things Tony Hancock. Our Twitter accounts, or should I say our X accounts, are East Team Lad, Tony Hancock Appreciation Society and Very Nearly an Armful.
This was the final episode in our current series. We'll be back after our Christmas break in the spring. So don't forget to rate, review and subscribe for forthcoming episodes.
For now, that's Very Nearly an Armful, so I'll say ta-ta.
It's sayonara from me.
Chickadee Stitch. And this is GLK London signing off for some turkey feet and chips.
Before that, you've got to scrub the floor, wash the dishes, clean the air house, wash the curtains. And
this has been an official podcast of the Tony Hancock Appreciation Society. Unfortunately, it was not written by Alan Simpson and Ray Gordon, whoever they are. The announcer was me, Robin Sebastian, currently appearing in the saloon bar of the Hendon Racket.
And this is GLK London signing off for some turkey and chips.
Hey.
Turkey feet and chips?
I'll do that again. Don't put that in the edit.
No, keep that in, eh?
And this is... No.
Last of the series as well.
And this is GLK London signing off for turkey feet and chips.
Doesn't quite sound the same as turkey... Turkey and chips.
You've got to hang up your stockings. You've got to hang up your stockings tomorrow night, guys.
Yes.
Well, before that, you've got to scrub the floor, wash the dishes, clean the air house, wash the curtains, you know, all of that.
Don't forget, we've got to clean that copper.
Can't get his helmet clean.
I love that. Yeah.
Have you tried the coupons come through the letterbox?
Oh, just go all soggy, don't they?
We'll keep that. Mark it fab.